Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Popes and Roman Water. We delve back into the past and discover the key role past popes played in helping to ensure a constant flow of clean, fresh water through the aqueducts and fountains of the Eternal City. And forgiveness and redemption. We talk to the founder of the Cherish Life Circle in New York City that reaches out to the families of murder victims and to the criminal on death row. But first, we report on Pope Benedict's Wednesday General Audience.
A 1,000 pilgrims packed into the courtyard of the papal summer residence in Castel Gandolfo for Pope Benedict's first weekly general audience since returning from his vacation in the Italian Alps. As he promised during his Angelus on Sunday, he dedicated his catechesis to St. John Vianney, the Curé of Ars, who is the patron of the Year of Priests.
This church celebrated the 150th anniversary of the days of St. John Vianney, the Curé of Ars, who is a patron saint of parish priests. In this year for priests, let us pray that through his intercession all priests will be renewed in love of the Lord, in the joyful pursuit of holiness, and in generous commitment to the spread of the gospel.
Pope Benedict told of the life of this humble priest who was born into a poor rural French family. St. John Vianney was illiterate into his late teens, but through dedication and prayer he persevered in his studies and was ordained at the age of 29. The life of the priest as the curate in the small town of Ars was dedicated to his parishioners. The Pope pointed out his dedication to the Eucharist and to confession.
Il vero segreto del suo successo pastorale è stato l'amore che nutriva per il mistero eucaristico annunciato, celebrato e vissuto, che è divenuto amore delle pecore di Cristo, dei cristiani, delle persone che cercano Dio. Saluto cordialmente tutti voi, particolarmente il quinto meeting verso Assisi dei Giovani.
At the end of the audience, Pope Benedict gave a special greeting to the participants of the fifth international meeting of Youth Towards Assisi. The week-long meeting will bring together young people from around the world and tries to help them grow in their faith by following the footsteps of St. Francis and St. Clare. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
The constant flow of fresh water through the aqueducts and fountains of Rome has been a characteristic feature of the city since its earliest beginnings. In the torrid heat of the summer, Romans and tourists alike are grateful for the abundance of fresh water that flows from these fountains and the hundreds of simple street taps throughout the city. But how many people are aware that had it not been for the vision and generosity of a succession of past popes, hot and thirsty pilgrims may have found it much harder to find a ready source of refreshing water whilst exploring the Eternal City. I've been finding out more about the key role a number of these popes played, both in ensuring a plentiful supply of pure water to the populace and in commissioning some of the city's most famous and beautiful fountains. My interviewee is Elizabeth Lev, Professor of Christian Art and Architecture at the Rome campus of Duquesne University.
Well, I think it's one of the most delightful things about Rome, the way that water is everywhere. Everywhere you turn, there's a water spigot or just a beautiful fountain. But that's part of Rome's history. And when the first Romans settled on those seven hills, half the reason was because it was riddled with underground springs. There would never be a lack of fresh water in the city.
And I gather that during the Roman Empire, there were no fewer than 12 aqueducts supplying water to some 1,300 fountains. That's a pretty amazing feat when you think how long ago it was and how few people there were living in the city compared to now.
As a matter of fact, the population of Rome under the empire had 1 million. Now Rome has something like 3 million, which it has to supply water to. But the water supply of Rome grew as Rome did. So Rome started out using its cisterns, underground springs, and of course the Tiber water. But by 312 BC, there wasn't enough water for the burgeoning city on the hills. So the first aqueduct was born, thanks to Appius Claudius, which brought water 10 kilometers into the city. And from then, it grew and grew and grew to end up with a colossal 12 aqueducts.
But then I gather that during the Dark Ages, all that fell into disrepair. And the city turned to using water from the Tiber.
Apparently, on page 2 or 3 of the Barbarian Siege Manual, it suggests to break the aqueducts, and the result of that was to push all the people on the hills back down towards the plain, where they could be close to the only source of water left, which was that of the Tiber.
And how long did they carry on using the water from the Tiber then?
They used it for almost 1,000 years, until the papacies of the Renaissance.
And it was Pope Sixtus IV, I gather, who reconditioned the Aqua Virgo Aqueduct in the late 1400s, and that was the start, wasn't it, of another sort of golden age as far as water is concerned.
Under many senses, Sixtus IV's pontificate was a golden age. The first man to span the Tiber with a bridge, the man who built the Sistine Chapel, and the man who repristined what was known as the best of all the aqueducts, the Aqua Virgo. Because the water from that aqueduct was always known to be the purest, the cleanest, the most limpid of all.
And I gather it's still in operation today, is that
right?
Oh,
yes it is. The Aqua Vergine is still working today.
But it wasn't just this pope, Pope Sixtus IV, who did all this work. I gather that the successive popes also, they created new aqueducts, they brought more water into the city, built fountains. Can you tell us something about particularly this building of the aqueduct?
Oh yes, not exactly coincidentally. The next great aqueduct-building pope will be Pope Sixtus V, who is pope from 1585 to 1590. He built his own aqueduct known as the Aqua Felice, which means the happy aqueduct. But it actually refers to his first name, which was Felice. And he brought water in from the top of the Quirinal Hill and flooded the city, really revived the construction of the city so that the city would develop back along the Quirinal Hill.
And as far as we know, what prompted them to do this? I mean, was there a religious significance behind it, or was it really just an act of papal generosity?
Water to the city historically has always been connected with generosity. The Appius Claudius who offers this aqueduct, the Marcia family which offers another aqueduct, the emperor who would build an aqueduct. But when the papacy started to rebuild and repristine these aqueducts, yes, it is, again, an act of great papal generosity, is an act of reviving and rebuilding Rome. But I don't think you can separate this use of water, this flow of water through the city, from that sense of the call to conversion, the sense of baptism, the sense of renewal, all of these implications that water has.
What do you think was the most outstanding in terms of the engineering work concerned, or maybe just in the amount of water that it supplied, if you had to sort of look at all these projects and pinpoint one of them?
If we're talking about the ancient Rome, by the time the empire is underway, by the 2nd century AD, the aqueducts were bringing 1 million liters of water into Rome a day. It was an incredible flow of water through the city. But without the same economic resources that the imperial Rome had, without the same, even the manpower and slavery that ancient Rome had, without the same population and without the same ability to gather funds, papal Rome managed to pristine all of these aqueducts and bring back this water that would flow through the city. So it's interesting to see how the underdog, in a certain sense, which was papal Rome compared to imperial Rome, was able to recreate that great generosity of water. If it hadn't have been for these really visionary popes, they did many other things. They were concentrating on water, but these popes also had a great vision of creating out of Rome the center of the church, a place where people would come from lands and cities where there isn't much water, or where there wouldn't be bridges, or it wouldn't be so well set out and laid out as a city. And you would come to Rome and you would see through the flow of the water, through the organization of the roads, through the well-constructed city, you would see the greatness of the heart of Christendom.
Now, a lot of this water was going to feed the fountains, and of course Rome is world famous for its fountains. How instrumental was the role of the papacy here in commissioning these fountains throughout the centuries?
There are 1,500 ornamental fountains in one way or another in Rome. About three-quarters of them were built by the papacy. The popes created the particularly beautiful fountains are what is known as a show, and it's when the aqueduct first brings the water into the city. It's the moment that the water first emerges from the aqueduct and flows into its first fountain. And the shows are the ones that you know, the people know best. The Trevi Fountain is the show for the Acqua Vergine. The Moses Fountain on the top of the Quirinal Hill is the show for the Acqua Felice. And so they created these very big, beautiful fountains to celebrate the arrival of the water into the city. And then they were responsible for the cute little decorative fountains that would be in a corner of one street or tucked away into a piazza.
So let's take some of these famous fountains. The Moses Fountain, for instance, what Pope helped?
It was Sixtus V who ordered the construction of the Moses Fountain, and it's designed in the form of a triumphal arch. There are three arches, so again, the triumph of water, the arrival of water as it first emerges from the aqueduct. And the image shows Moses striking the rock for the water to leap forth, and then next to him there are these supplementary images of Aaron, the chief priest, and the people waiting for the water. And it's decorated in the front with four basalt lions, which were at once upon a time, Egyptian lions, which are now in the Vatican museums, but at the time they were lions that had been brought in from Egypt. And it makes a very kind of dramatic sense of triumph, which is a big part of this pontificate.
Now, of course, for most tourists, the Trevi Fountain is the most famous for a number of reasons. Can you tell us something about the papal role here?
Well, the Trevi Fountain starts as an ancient Roman aqueduct, is the show for the Acqua Vergine, which was built by the son-in-law and designated heir of Augustus, who was Agrippa in 25 BC. Now, that aqueduct, like all the others, fell into disuse, but it was legendary for the sweetness and the purity of its water. In the 1640s, Pope Urban VIII had the idea of getting people to move back onto the Quirinal Hill, moving away from the overcrowded area near the river. And he saw that Sixtus IV had already repristined the aqueduct. Water was already flowing into that area. But to create a kind of draw, he projected a very grand fountain for that show. And he started out by hiring none other than Gian Lorenzo Bernini. And Gian Lorenzo Bernini began by designing the square, not the fountain, so that the first thing that we all remember about the Trevi is the way we happened on it by surprise. I think everyone who's seen the Trevi Fountain remembers being kind of wandering through streets, wondering where this fountain is, and then... the shock and surprise of encountering the fountain, and that was the work of Bernini. Now, the project then lay unattended to for almost 100 years. And it was just let go because it was too expensive, because it was too complicated, because there wasn't much interest. But between 1730 and 1740, the Corsini Pope decided to call up a contest to see who could come up with the best design. And Niccolò Salvi won the contest for designing the Trevi Fountain. Poor Niccolò Salvi didn't even live to see his fountain completed. It wasn't done until Benedict XIV's reign in 1762.
And Piazza Navona, of course, the Four Rivers fountain there. Is there a papal link to this as well?
Well, that fountain is one of the most famous papal fountains of all. That fountain is, for art historians, it's the fountain that got Bernini back into papal graces, because there had been a big blow-up between Pope Innocent X and the artist Bernini in 1644, basically. Over the facade of St. Peter's, they were constructing a bell tower, and Bernini was in charge of the construction, and a crack formed in the facade of St. Peter's, and Innocent X, of course, was infuriated. There were a number of Bernini detractors who were ready to whisper in the ear of Innocent X, and Bernini had been sent away in disgrace from papal court. Now, in 1650, Innocent X wanted to build a fountain for what was essentially his front yard. The Pamphili Palace is the palace on the Piazza Navona that looks out over the Four Rivers Fountain. And he wanted a fountain that would combine an obelisk with this ancient Egyptian monument that were beginning to pop up all over the city. But at the same time, he wanted to bring water to the piazza out of that same generous appearance of the papacy. But everybody who presented projects to him presented the same thing, sort of an obelisk, a trough, water. It wasn't very exciting. And the Pope was dissatisfied. Well, Bernini made a sterling silver model of the fountain that you see today, and he had it left in the Pope's apartments. And when the Pope came in and saw that model of the fountain, he said, "This is my fountain. This is the one. Who made it?" And when he heard that the artist was Bernini, he said, "Those who would not use the works of Bernini had better not look at them." And so Bernini was back in papal graces and constructing that wonderful fountain of the Four Rivers.
Elizabeth Leff, Professor of Christian Art and Architecture in Rome. Helping the families of murder victims and also the criminal who's facing the death penalty. Those are the twin activities of the Cherished Life Circle, a group in the US founded by the Sisters of Mercy to advocate for the abolition of capital punishment. The circle's primary goal is to campaign for the abolition of the death penalty through civil discourse and programs that uphold the sacredness of all life. One of its key activities is the annual holding of an ecumenical candlelight prayer service for the families of murder victims. Other activities include corresponding with people awaiting execution on death row, and also sometimes acting as a spiritual advisor to one or more of those prisoners. The Cherished Life Circle believes that no matter how horrendous the crime convicted, the perpetrator is a human being capable of repentance and turning over a new leaf. The circle was founded in 1993 by Camille D'Arienzo, a sister of mercy based in New York City, together with other religious sisters from the order. She told me more about their aims and activities.
I formed the Cherish Life Circle in 1993 when Governor Mario Cuomo, who was an ardent advocate of the abolition of the death penalty, was going out of office, and the then Governor Pataki was coming into office hoping to restore the death penalty to New York State. We did not have it at that time in our state. I have in my circle of friends, religious, lay, and priests, people who have come together to discuss the significant issues of our times, war and peace, poverty. And when we looked at this, we said, what are we going to do to enter this dialogue? So we came together as we do, who pray, who speak, who write, who have educational platforms, and we began to promote that.
Now, I know that one of the things you do is organize an annual candlelit ecumenical service for people who have suffered the loss of their loved ones through murder. Can you tell us very briefly something about that?
Yes, I will tell you first, though, as a founder of the Cherish Life Circle, through circumstances not of my choosing, but now of my great appreciation, I am a spiritual advisor to a man on death row in Terre Haute, Indiana, David Paul Hammer. So I know very well the suffering of those who are awaiting execution. Some years ago, we began to reach out to those relatives and friends of people who had been murdered. And every year at our Convent of Mercy in Brooklyn, we have a service which invites people who have so suffered. It is not a Catholic service because most of the people who come to us in the New York area are people of color, many from the Protestant tradition.
It must be a very emotional and moving thing. I mean, presumably a lot of people must choke up, you know, at this service. What's it like?
Yes. We had a woman come as an observer for the first time. Now, she didn't have anyone die in her own family, but she was looking to plan a similar service in her parish. And I watched this woman, Dr. Clara Garrett, sitting there listening to the stories of these heartbroken people, and tears just wet her face. One of the surprising things about these services, only once have we had anyone call for the death penalty for the person who murdered his son. Now, I think that's extraordinary. It is much more common for us to see these wounded, faith-filled people say, I don't want another mother to suffer the pain I have endured. So they want punishment, but not execution.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you are spiritual advisor to a man on death row called David Hammer. Can you briefly sketch for us the reason that he ended up on death row and how long he's been there?
David Paul Hammer is 49 years old, and he has been continually incarcerated since he was 19. He grew up in poverty in the state of Oklahoma with parents who were migrant workers and a mother who was abusive. They moved around a great deal so that his education was never complete. It was a different school every few months. By the time he was 16 and the victim of psychological, physical, sexual abuse, he ran away, got into drugs, married at 16, fathered a child, and at 19, was involved in armed robbery. He had been before the judge a number of times, and in, I guess, exasperation, the judge then sentenced him to 1,200 years, no possibility of parole. Now, at 19, when he heard the doors slam behind him, he had no reason to accommodate the system, whereas no social system had served him well. So he continued to do, you know, negative things in prison, and in 1996, he murdered a cellmate, for which he got the death penalty. But in the meantime, he underwent a conversion and has become, well, they call him at Terre Haute the unofficial chaplain. He is so good with the other inmates. He's brilliant, and he's a paralegal. He takes care of their appeals. He looks out for their special needs. No one on death row has money, and most of them are there because of poor counsel. He helps them in 100 ways. He also designs Christmas cards, which we sell every year, and we have probably contributed over $50,000 or $60,000 to help children in need. David was confirmed a Catholic, brought into the faith, in his cell in Terre Haute, Indiana, in October of 2000.
Now, you said he had a very abusive childhood, particularly his mother. There was one incident there that you told me about earlier that involved a puppy, right?
Mm-hmm. When David was about 10 years old, he had a younger brother, slightly retarded, and a still younger sister, probably about 6 years old. Someone took compassion on these really poor children, hungry, very often hungry children, not cared for, and clearly being abused. And they gave the family a puppy. Now, anyone who has ever owned a dog knows how quickly the bonding occurs. And so it was that in the course of the day, the three children played with the dog. They owned it. They loved it. And when the mother came home, she went into one of her irrational fits. She sent David up to the house, the shack, to get a burlap bag. And she sent the two younger children away. Then she forced David to watch her while she clubbed the puppy to death. He screamed in protest, screamed and cried, and to no avail. And when the puppy was dead, she forced David to drag the burlap bag to the nearby pond and throw it in. It was kind of interesting that the last day that David was supposed to be executed, his execution date was set, but that night he called a friend in Indianapolis, and he said, "I want you to do me a favor. I want you to go to the dog pound, and I want you to rescue a dog that is slated to be executed, slated for death, an unwanted animal." He said, "I can't save another human being, but perhaps I can save a dog." And so the woman he called went, and she got the dog, and David calls that his dog, which was trained to visit elderly people in the nursing homes. And so that dog lives because David lives. But I'm sure there's a connection with that childhood memory.
Okay, coming back to the families of murder victims, have you got any feedback from those who you have helped or any other poignant anecdotes to share with us?
Oh, there are so many. One of the first services, it might have been the very first one we had, we pre-register everybody. We make out signs that bear the names of the murdered person, and the family member representing the murdered person wears that sign in the chapel during the service. Well, just as the service was about to begin, I could hear someone running up the steps. And there was a young boy, all dressed in suit and tie and brown shoes. It's a small African-American child. And I said, "Honey, what are you doing here?" And he said, "My mama sent me." I said, but do you know what this is?" And he said, "Yes, my mama only heard today that it's for people who were murdered. My brother was murdered." "How old was he?" "He was 15. My mom is sick. She couldn't come, so she sent me." "How did you get here?" "I took two trains." The boy was 10 years old. So, you know, we quickly made a sign and added his brother's name to the list. And we seated him with some of the mothers in the chapel. And when his brother's name was called and he stood to go to the center aisle, to go into the sanctuary with his lighted candle, which was part of the ritual, he burst out crying. His little shoulders shook and mothers surrounded him and brought him up, you know, to the sanctuary. And it was a very moving moment. And then when the service was over, I looked for that child. I needed more information about him, but he was gone. He wasn't where the refreshments were. He wasn't out on the street. But that boy in the brown shoes remains in my mind almost 10 years now as kind of the angel that alerts us to the fact that children should not see that violence has the last word, and that faith can help individuals to overcome the worst hardships, and that there is a community of support.
So you never found out where he came from or anything more?
No,
about him?
Nothing.
I was speaking there to Camille D'Arienzo, a Sister of Mercy from New York City.
That's all from Vatican Radio's English program for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. Laudato Jesus Christus.